Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For weeks, North Carolinians have been living under stay-at-home orders issued by local municipalities and by Governor Cooper in efforts to reduce the number of COVID-19 infections. By all measures, that attempt has been successful, and polls show that most North Carolinians, indeed most Americans, support these initiatives. But there have been pockets of protests here and around the country. The closing of most businesses and the concurrent loss of income has understandably raised anxieties, but it's also raised questions about whether or not our elected officials have overstepped their bounds. Ashley Smith is an organizer with Reopen NC.
Today I say no more.
No more.
From this moment on, I do not consent.
Her sentiments have been expressed all over the country. Protests have been peaceful for the most part, but in some cases there has been an air of danger attached. In Michigan, protesters marched into the State House carrying automatic weapons, demanding the governor there liberate Michigan. Around the country, there are a growing number of lawsuits challenging these measures. Some of these suits allege violations of the right to due process and equal protections under the 14th Amendment, which prohibits states from abridging the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. Can states order people to stay home? Can they, in the name of public safety, close businesses for an indefinite amount of time? Are these moves unconstitutional? For answers, we turn on This Politics Monday to two experts on constitutional law. William Marshall is the William R. Keenan, Jr. Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina School of Law, where he teaches constitutional law, the First Amendment, among other things. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Gregory Wallace teaches constitutional law with an emphasis on free speech, church and state, the right to arms, and constitutional interpretation at Campbell University in Raleigh. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
As we go through the program, you can email us, get to us through Twitter or even Facebook if you have questions about all of this. Let me start with hearing from both of you on the key question in this conversation, which may end the show just like that at the very start, because the question is pretty simple. Are governments at any level within their power to order people to stay at home or order them to close their businesses until we say so? Are these actions constitutional, or are these actions open to interpretation? I'll hear from both of you. I'll start with William Marshall. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that any possible order is automatically constitutional. I think it has to be closely tied to the interests at stake. But in 1905, the United States Supreme Court ruled in a case dealing with the smallpox epidemic that communities can act for the self-defense of their members, and they can take extraordinary actions to protect the community at large. But I think that it's correct that those actions can be tested against constitutional parameters. If the order goes too long, if it's unreasonable, if it goes beyond what the health requirements are, then yeah, I think there can be serious constitutional arguments brought against them.
Greg Wallace, I'm gonna bet that you agree.
I do. And the case that Bill was referring to there had to do with a local government actually forcing people to be vaccinated against smallpox, and the Supreme Court upheld that. I think the governments have wide powers in emergencies like this to issue these types of orders, but I agree with Bill that they are still subject to constitutional limitations.
But where is the right to close a business or order you to stay in your house? Where is that in the document that we call the Constitution? Where would I find that?
Well, like so many other things, the Constitution doesn't explicitly stay out, but remember, this is part of state power, and the Constitution doesn't really speak to the power of the states in general. The question is, you assume that the state has the power to act, and then you ask whether or not there are constitutional defenses to that particular exercise of authority. But the broader theme that's in the Constitution is that governments can act in favor of the general welfare. And when the general welfare is threatened by something like a disease, the government can step in and try to assist the population.
And do you know if these clauses that permit this kind of activity on the part of state governments are in state constitutions? And would the state constitutions be constitutional under the U.S. Constitution if they were? Gregory.
Yeah, Bill's right that we have a divided government in this country. We have a national government, and we have state governments and their local government subdivisions. And I think what we're seeing is a marvelous lesson on what we constitutional law teachers call federalism, where we have these two different governments working at the same time. And the national government is a government of limited powers. State governments and their local government subdivisions have what's called the general police power. And that typically either comes from the state constitution or it's just assumed because that's the nature of government. The government, and when we call what we call the police power, is the power of the government to act in the interest of the health, safety, well-being, morals of the people. And that's a power that really is focused in state governors and states and counties. It's not something that the federal government, although its powers are vast, the federal government doesn't have this general police power. So that's why you're seeing these stay-at-home orders being issued by state governors rather than by President Trump.
Bill Marshall, you brought up, I think, the Supreme Court ruling in 1905. I was thinking yesterday when I was getting ready to talk to you folks that we'd be citing references that go back to the flu pandemic, but this goes back even further. This was a smallpox outbreak, and you cited a Supreme Court ruling during that smallpox epidemic. What did it say?
Massachusetts versus Jacobson. And what it said was that the state has the right, and they almost used the language of self-defense, that the state has the right to promote the self-defense of the community by being able to act to prevent the spread of an epidemic. And that's literally what the case said.
Would it be accurate to say, though, Greg, that in fact, this idea of the state acting in defense of the welfare of the citizenry at large goes back even further? It goes back to the time the Constitution was written. It was written in the shadow of a quarantine in Philadelphia for yellow fever. They had just gone through that. So they were very familiar with quarantining people in to help the public at large? Or do we assume that had they opposed the quarantine, they would have written that into the Constitution?
Yeah, I think it's, as Bill said earlier, that there are a lot of things that the Constitution doesn't address. And one of the things that it doesn't address are the specific powers that states have to act in this particular way. Now, of course, state governors and local authorities are still subject to the limitations in, for example, the Bill of Rights to the Constitution. But the general police power is something that has long been assumed that is the power of government. The reason why the federal government doesn't have general police power is because in Article 1 of the Constitution, it says that all powers herein, all legislative power herein enumerated, and that has been traditionally understood to create a federal government that doesn't have general police power, a national government that has limited powers. Now, you know, our modern day-to-day, when you look at the size and scope of the federal government, you would wonder, you know, what limitations are there on its powers? But that's the traditional view of the Constitution. And I think that's why we have this division of government, because there are just certain things like this kind of problem that are better addressed locally.
The people who are, it's a small minority of people, but those who are protesting because their individual rights are being abridged by the stay-at-home orders and by the closing of business. I have a right to make a living. I have a right to go to my business and keep it open. My rights. But there are also the rights of the people around you. How does the Constitution address where my rights intersect or interfere with your rights, Bill?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point here. I mean, one of the reasons why government actually grew in the first place was response to disease, because that's a situation where, as you point out, if an individual acts independently, they might be threatening the safety and the health of everybody around them. So if there's ever a situation where you need government to step in, this is exactly the kind of situation that occurs.
But where's the legal precedent for that, for the government stepping in to protect the other person's rights over your rights, which are guaranteed in the Constitution?
I think that's, you know, that's what that case, the smallpox case, was sort of talking about. This is exactly where the power of government steps in to be able to stop me from harming people around me. And is there a clear line on that? Absolutely not. I'm like, so much in constitutional law, their boundaries, as Greg was pointed out, that are not always clear lines. But in this particular instance, the idea that government can step in to protect the community as a whole, because individuals, although they have rights, may at the same time threaten the lives of someone else, is deeply established, not just in our Constitution, but I think in Western government generally.
At the Reopen NC protest in Raleigh a couple of weeks ago, police arrested at least one protester near the legislature who were accused of violating the stay-at-home order. And Raleigh police called that protest a non-essential activity. Something very familiar, or similar rather, happened here in Charlotte, where for years a group has been protesting outside of a women's clinic, an abortion clinic. And during the stay-at-home order, they were asked not to, but they did anyway. And I believe an arrest was made in that because of violations of social distancing requirements. What does the Constitution say about our rights to protest and government powers to infringe on our rights to protest in these special circumstances, Greg?
I think the statement by the Raleigh Police Department that protesting is a non-essential activity was unfortunate. I'm not sure who wrote that. I think it sent very much the wrong message. The Constitution doesn't have a pandemic exception when it comes to the rights that it protects, nor are my constitutional rights limited to what I can do at home in under these stay-at-home orders. But having said that, there is long-established precedent in the free speech area that the government can impose reasonable time, place, manner restrictions on speech.
Well, I'm sure you want to pick up on that because I'm giving you the rap signal here, but we'll come back in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. At Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE, I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the constitutionality of the stay-at-home orders and the closure of businesses around the country with two professors of law. Bill Marshall is professor of law at the UNC School of Law, and Gregory Wallace is professor of law at Campbell University in Raleigh. You were talking just before the break, Greg, about the unfortunate use of the term that the Raleigh police used when referring to a protest as being a non-essential activity. Are protests ever non-essential under the Constitution?
No, I think you have the obvious protection in the First Amendment of the right to peaceably assemble to express your messages to the government. So I don't think that is non-essential, but at the same time, the right to free speech and the right to assemble are not absolute. And the Supreme Court has long held that the government can put content neutral time, place, and manner restrictions on the exercise of speech. Now, in this case, I think the social distancing requirements of 6 feet between protesters would be a reasonable place or manner type of restriction on these protesters. My only concern would be, I think the one of the protests in Raleigh was broken up. I think the initial one, which that unfortunate tweet followed, was they were broken up because they exceeded the 10 plus rule set by Governor Cooper. And I'm a little uncomfortable with that from a constitutional perspective, because I mean, you have, there are all sorts of places where more than 10 people are gathering: gas stations, grocery stores, liquor stores. There are even more than 10 people. I don't know about you, but I've used fast food restaurants several times, and there are typically more than 10 people in line at a fast food restaurant. So I have a little more problem with the 10 plus rule, but I do not with the social distancing.
Yeah, I think what Greg's pointing out, and he's exactly right, is that these kind of regulations are presumptively okay in an area like this, but you have to make sure that they're content neutral. I mean, if you're allowing one kind of protest and not another, then that's problematic. But if it's actually a neutral rule, and if there's a strong reason for it, then the thumb is going to be on the side of the government that it can impose neutral time, place, and manner restrictions on the protest.
So the First Amendment guarantees the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. But it would be right to say that the government, Greg, can arrest you in a protest situation for breaking other laws. They don't have to say, if you're in the abortion protest here in Charlotte, they're not arresting you because you're protesting against abortion or trying to protest in favor of the right to life, but because you are social, you're not practicing the social distancing that are temporarily in force. It's okay to do that.
Yes.
Yes. I think Bill and I both agree on that. My question would be, were they actually violating the social distancing rules? And as I said, I have a little more problem with the 10 plus rule from a constitutional standpoint. But yes, they can arrest you. And I think Bill and I would both agree that these social distancing rules are presumptively constitutional at this point.
So in Michigan, a group of protesters, as I mentioned in the beginning, chose to carry automatic weapons into the state house, even into the gallery of one of the chambers that the lawmakers use. The First Amendment guarantees our right to redress grievances and to assemble to do so. The Second Amendment protects our right to bear arms. Carrying firearms, though, into a legislative body, it's certainly an act of intimidation. I suppose it might be interpreted as an act of terrorism in some people's minds, but is it constitutional? And is that what the framers had in mind? Bill?
Well, Greg is one of the national experts on Second Amendment rights. So I'm going to turn it over for him for the first track, if that's okay.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, to begin with, these were not automatic weapons. These were semi-automatic AR-15 style weapons. And but nevertheless, I think it depends. A lot of states have what we might call place restrictions on sensitive places where you can carry firearms. And one of the things that the Supreme Court said in the Heller decision in 2008 was that even though the court recognized a broad individual right to carry firearms or to keep and bear arms, that it's these laws that protect sensitive places like courthouses or schools are presumptively constitutional. And so I'm surprised that Michigan didn't have a law that prohibited carrying firearms into the state capitol building. And likely a law like that would be upheld as constitutional under the sensitive place language of Heller. But as far as open carry in the protest, I think that that's something that's protected here in North Carolina under the state constitution. We have a right to openly carry firearms in public places. And I think that these people who were carrying them are generally law-abiding citizens. I don't think in any of these protests, I can't remember a recent protest where people showed up armed, where anybody got shot. So I think that's, I think they're trying to send a message. I think that's part of their message that they're trying to convey here. But as far as carrying them into the state house, I think that probably could be prohibited and not run afoul of the Second Amendment.
But isn't it also, we have these laws on the books now that terrorism laws that have severe penalties for acts of terrorism. Couldn't these acts of intimidation where you carry a semi-automatic weapon into a state house to protest whatever you're protesting, doesn't matter what you're protesting, that kind of intimidation could be interpreted under those laws as an act of terrorism?
Well, you could say that about anybody carrying a firearm in public. And I think there are a number of states that already by either amendment to the state constitution or by state statute that prohibit carrying firearms in public. Other states, as I said, here in North Carolina, we have a rather old state Supreme Court case said that you can carry firearms in public, as long as you're not brandishing those weapons, as long as you're not pointing them at people or otherwise threatening with people. The mere carrying of a firearm in public, in most places, unless you're in one of these sensitive places, like a school or a courthouse or a state government building, would be considered perfectly acceptable under the Constitution.
You know, I think without spending too much more time on this, the Second Amendment rights are pretty much in their infancy before the court. They've done very few cases. A case was up there this term, and the court dismissed it on procedural grounds. It's going to take us some time to develop the full parameter of the constitutional rights to carry guns for concealed carry and those kinds of things. I think Greg has got his fingers exactly on the pulse of where we are right now, but that may change as cases develop.
Business closures in North Carolina and around the country have not been universal, even within the some counties or states. Some businesses were deemed essential, and they therefore could remain open under certain restrictions. When Gaston County Commissioner Commission Chairman Tracy Philbeck last week tried to issue a proclamation opening his county for business in spite of state orders to the contrary, he said, quote, "Instead of the governor picking winners and losers, which I believe is unconstitutional, that is not equal protection under the law. He should just apply best practices that we've learned for all businesses." So if by choosing which businesses can open and which cannot, that is picking winners and losers, does that make it unconstitutional, as Tracy Philbeck believes? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of.
I'll take a first crack at it. I think the again, the government's going to have a lot of deference here on picking and choosing which kind of businesses create greater kind of health risks. I do think that if at the point that the distinctions look completely arbitrary without any rational basis whatsoever, then maybe a court might step in and saying, look, what's the reason here? But as long as the government can articulate a plausible reason as to why it's going to allow one type of business to stay open and one not, I mean, you know, a good example would be takeout restaurants versus dining in restaurants. There are health reasons to distinguish between the two. As long as the state can come up with a plausible and sensible reason to distinguish it, its distinctions are going to be upheld. Does that mean one state might have a different conclusion on that than another state? Sure. But I think that the level of scrutiny that a court's going to give this is whether or not the distinction actually is grounded in a legitimate health concern.
Well, up in Michigan, which has become the poster child for all this suddenly, some of the protesters are upset because the governor of Michigan said you cannot use a motorboat, but you can go canoeing, kayaking, sailing, but you cannot use a motorboat. And they thought that that was indiscriminate. Here in North Carolina, we had, evidently you couldn't buy a lawnmower in certain lawn and garden stores until last week. And yet the big box stores like Lowe's and Home Depot have been open during all of this because they were deemed essential and you could buy a lawnmower from them. Are these rules sloppy and arbitrary and capricious? And if so, does that fly in the face of constitutionality?
Yes, I think some of these rules are very sloppy and very inconsistent, but most of them are only going to be tested by the courts, as Bill said, using a sort of arbitrary and irrational type of standard, unless they implicate constitutional rights. Let's take the situation in Michigan. I don't think anybody has a constitutional right to use a motorboat over a canoe or a kayak. On the other hand, one of the rules in Michigan was that people who had vacation homes in upstate Michigan could not travel from down south to those residences upstate, but yet people coming in from out of state could certainly go to those residences. And I think that might implicate the constitutional right to travel. And the question again, as Bill suggested a moment ago, is does the state have a sufficient justification for making that distinction? And is that justification narrowly tailored to achieve that particular interest there, that particular reason?
Tom emails, if state action forces small businesses to close but allows larger competitors to remain open, doesn't that violate the Equal Protection Clause? And if a business is forced to close, hasn't it been deprived of property without due process? Bill.
You know, the answer there, again, is there has to be a plausible and sufficient reason as to why one kind of business is allowed to stay open and one isn't. When the government acts in a situation like this, it has to make a lot of decisions quickly. There will be deference given. I think this is what Greg was talking about. There's going to be deference given to the government to make its decision, and it may have to show why it's not arbitrary and capricious. If a business does go under, that would not be considered a taking, which is what Tom, I think, was referring to. There is a provision in the Constitution which prohibits the taking of property without compensation, but the government isn't taking anything here. That usually means a physical taking. If the government wants to take my house, my property, so that it can run a railroad through it, that is a physical taking. Something like this, a regulatory taking is what it would be called, doesn't amount to the same kind of constitutional violation, and a court's going to look at that much more deferentially.
But if you're an employee who is no longer working because your business was forced to close, is not the government taking your salary? They're prohibiting you from collecting your salary because you can't work?
They might. They're certainly prohibiting you from collecting your salary, but they're not taking it. They're not taking the money themselves. That is what the physical taking part of it was. Governments do all kinds of things that affect the ability of people to earn money and how much they can earn. all of those are not subject to heightened, what we call heightened constitutional scrutiny, and certainly are not subject to what we would call a takings analysis, because again, that first threshold requirement, the government is not actually physically taking something.
It appears that we are coming out of this first phase of protective measures against COVID-19. We may have to go back into them depending upon what happens when we come out, but right now we're coming out. So the objections that people have, and perhaps the lawsuits that they may or may not be filing, will most of these be settled way after this pandemic is in the distance? And if so, will it inform how we handle another one in the future?
Oh, yeah. The answer to all of that is it might be that courts won't have the time to come up with definitive answers, although I do think there's going to be enough time with some of these that we're going to see more judicial rulings. Again, there's not much case law out there on these kinds of issues. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a while before that completely germinates. We might go back into this, and we might very well go back into this again.
So, Greg, I think one of the things that Bill Marshall just talked about was this connection to public health and formulating rules. They're going to be cut some slack, governments, by courts. Michael Dorff, a constitutional scholar at Cornell University, believes the state has to show some rational basis for restrictions and in their connection to public health. And he adds that during a pandemic, that's a pretty low bar to hurdle. Does that mean that public safety, the general welfare, all of those things trump the Constitution or even rational restrictions, at least temporarily in these times of emergency?
Well, I think if what Professor Dorff said was if I understood that correctly, I think it depends on the kind of practice or the kind of activity that the government is burdening with its regulations. If it is an activity that is not constitutionally protected, and there are a lot of activities that are not constitutionally protected, then it's going to be subject to this standard of review that Bill and I have talked about of being arbitrary and capricious, where there are a lot of deference is given to the government. But if it interferes with a constitutional right, like the right to free speech, the right to freely exercise one's religion, the right to keep and bear arms, et cetera, then the standard of review is going to be higher and more exacting, not just this reasonable kind of rational basis type of review.
Greg Wallace is a professor of law at Campbell University. He's joined by William Marshall, who's a professor of law at UNC School of Law, and we'll continue to look at the constitutionality of these stay-at-home orders and business closures and some other aspects of those in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with William Marshall, professor of law at UNC School of Law in Chapel Hill. Greg Wallace is also with us, a professor of law at Campbell University. We're talking about the Constitution and its intersection with COVID-19 and the restrictions that states and other areas have put into place here. So you told Spectrum News, Bill, that businesses are within their rights to sue over the state's stay-at-home order, but suing and winning are two different things. So our businesses, given all the things we've just talked about, the latitude that governments are given in times of emergency, are businesses wasting their time by suing?
You know, again, I think that in most cases they're going to end up losing. I mean, maybe as that, if assuming the health risks become less and less, and let's hope, I think we're all on the same page saying let's hope that happens, that it might be harder for a community to be able to maintain particular restrictions. And I think that's good. I mean, I think that one of the constitutional restrictions ought to be how long the particular regulation lasts. So maybe as the health risk lessens, these suits are likely to become more successful. But at least at the beginning, in the early stages, which I still think we haven't quite passed yet, most businesses are likely to lose unless they show something that's really arbitrary, and that's going to be very hard to do.
Well, I believe it was you earlier in this conversation who said that these stay-at-home orders may become problematic if they go on too long.
Yes.
Who determines how long is too long?
Well, I think a court may end up doing that. If a government doesn't voluntarily lift a particular order, and at that point, maybe a suit might have a greater degree of success if the health risk is not that great. There is a case not that long ago from New York City dealing with a restriction on people who hadn't had a measles vaccination, which doesn't obviously create the same kind of health risk. And a court looked at that quite harshly and said that restriction might not be justified by the health interests at stake. So I think as the science develops and as the health understanding develops, it's quite possible that later some suits might be successful if a community or a state keeps these restrictions in place for too long.
It's no secret, Greg, that the Trump administration wants to get back to work as normal as quickly as possible, and Attorney General William Barr has indicated support for legal challenges to these stay-at-home provisions, calling them, quote, very, very burdensome impingements on liberty. That's a key word, liberty. He is part of an administration that wants to reopen this country. He's also the country's leading law enforcement official. So is his opinion based in the Constitution or politics?
Well, it's probably a little bit of both. I certainly think most everybody would want the country to be reopened as quickly as possible with also guarding public health. And one of the things that I think that we have to understand about the reopening issue is that in many instances, what's happening with the so-called reopening is that you're simply shifting the decision about how to be safe from the government to the people. Even if restaurants, for example, reopen, there's still going to be a lot of people who are not going to go, at least in the initial stages, because they don't think it's safe. And I think what some people react to here is the government sort of playing big brother. At the beginning, at the outset, certainly that was necessary. But as it goes on too long, and Bill was talking about that, then I think more and more people are going to be frustrated with this and think, well, let me make the decision about, you know, that. Now, again, we're not in isolation here. And so I think some of those decisions are you know, if we reopen too fast, but that's where this whole thing of federalism comes in. That really these reopening things can be better tailored at the state and local level rather than some national reopening of every place at the same time.
I was going to ask you, given the concept of states' rights and federalism and how Republicans generally toe the line on giving more power to the states and taking it away from the federal government, should the federal government, in this case William Barr, be encouraging his fellow attorneys in the Justice Department to look into these cases that are happening at the state level under state rules that have been handed out by the Trump administration to the states? They didn't say we're going to handle this. They said you handle it.
Well, I think that the concern that he has is that some of these state rules are burdening constitutional rights, and that is probably where the focus is. It's not so much a general focus of just getting things reopened more quickly, because there are a number of businesses that you don't necessarily have a constitutional right to operate. And so we're back to this, you know, rational basis for keeping that. I don't think that's the kind of thing that he's looking at. I think he's looking at, I know the Department of Justice got involved in this this case out of Mississippi, where they closed down this drive-in church services. And so I think he's talking more about these types of situations where you have an interference with the exercise of constitutional rights.
So these rules that we have in place around the country, many of them are state rules, some of them are county rules, some of them are municipality rules. And here in North Carolina, one area at least had a curfew in place, maybe still does, during this pandemic. A couple of weeks ago in Swain County, a man was pulled over by a police officer for breaking the COVID-19-inspired curfew there. He had driven to a nearby town to get some fast food and a tub of ice cream. And on his way home, he was pulled over, and the officer recorded what happened next on his body cam. So listen to this and give us your ruling. The driver speaks first.
Have you heard of the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment and the Third Amendment and the Second Amendment?
I have.
All right. I just want to make sure you understand that curfews are not constitutional.
Well,
they're only for juveniles. The Supreme Court has ruled that curfews are constitutional for juveniles because they have restricted rights.
Actually, you're wrong.
I bet you I'm right.
I bet you you're wrong.
So the officer wrote him a ticket and charged him with a Class 2 misdemeanor punishable for up to 60 days in jail or a $1,000 fine. The man is now suing, alleging that his constitutional rights were violated. Bill, who's right?
Again, the community is going to have to defend the health reason for it. I don't think the Supreme Court, at least that I'm aware of, has ever held automatically that all curfews are unconstitutional. I think that's stepping things a little bit. I'm not sure what the Third Amendment has to do with this, which is deals with quartering soldiers in people's houses. But, I think that, again, the community, particularly in the case of a criminal prosecution, the constitutional rights are going to certainly be considered by the court. They're going to ask whether or not this kind of regulation was justifiable. And again, they're going to give quite a bit of deference to the particular community in making its decision.
We didn't play this, but there's another part to this story. Evidently, he was allowed to drive to this area to get fast food and a tub of ice cream until 10 o'clock. But at 10:01, the curfew took effect. Yeah. Therefore, what was legal at 9:59 was illegal at 10:51. Could that be interpreted as arbitrary?
You know, actually not, probably. That part is the least part of the problem. I mean, you can have a restriction and say no demonstrations in the park between midnight and 6 o'clock in the morning. And the fact that one can take place at 11:59 p.m., but not at 12:01 is not going to make that regulation unconstitutional. You have to make, you know, a speed limit can be 50. It doesn't have to be 51 or 49. The government can make decisions like that. They're going to take a look. When the court looks at this, they're going to take a look at whether the overall sense of the law works based on the health justification involved.
So the First Amendment of the Constitution also guarantees, Greg, freedom of religion. And during this pandemic, some governments have closed churches and mosques and synagogues only allowed them to open to groups of 10 or less, which effectively makes it impossible for congregations to assemble. Are the same rules we've been talking about in this hour, do they come into play here with regard to churches?
I think they do. You had a very interesting decision out of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals just last Friday that upheld a lower court injunction against a town in Kentucky from prohibiting drive-in services. And I think the biggest concern here is whether everybody's subject to the same types of rules. I know here in Wake County, they had some very odd guidelines for churches that were conducting drive-in services. You could put communion elements out on tables or church programs or Bible study materials out on tape, but the tables could not be, it could not have anybody behind them. And the cars that would pass, get this, there had to be a 6-foot distance between the cars, not just the people, but the cars. That was the guideline that Wake County published here. Now, those are no longer in effect. They went out on April 30th. But I think that's the question. Again, this 10-plus rule that I have some problems with. I mean, as I said earlier, you've got places, a lot of places, where more than 10 people are gathering as long as they're following these social distancing rules. And I'm not sure that that doesn't create a problem. And that was really the basis of this Sixth Circuit decision, was that you're applying a different set of rules to churches than you are to other establishments.
But if you're applying those rules to all churches, you're not just targeting one denomination or one religious faith. You're acting fairly against or in favor of all the health of all these congregations. Is that what the dividing line is? I mean, if they just picked the Baptists, that would be a problem.
Yeah, yes, of course, that would be an even greater problem, more obvious problem. But when you're treating religion per se different from other forms of secular activity, that's also can present a constitutional problem.
But if you're closing movie theaters and live theaters because you can't congregate and you can't enforce strict distancing regulations in those atmospheres, wouldn't the same be true of churches?
I think what Greg is saying is absolutely right. What you're saying is right. It has to be absolutely neutral. You can't allow political protests but not allow religious services. You have to have a law that you're applying equally across the board. And if you have that, I think it's going to survive constitutional scrutiny.
On the other side of the coin, some states have used this as an opportunity to close abortion clinics. Do the same principles apply there? If you're closing these clinics in the interest of public health, is that okay? But in states where there is a demonstrated prejudice against these clinics operating in regular times, is this just a thinly veiled way to get your way?
I think there are two answers on that. One is I would take a look in any of these states to see what other kind of medical procedures they're allowing. And if they're allowing some, but not this one, then it might look like they're singling this out for adverse treatment, and that might trigger a red flag. Also, you have a problem with abortion that you don't have with a lot of other medical procedures, is there's obviously a time limit. And so a court might take a harder look at this because, in effect, the regulation is, although it looks temporary, ends up being permanent because of the time exigencies involved. And I think that's what the courts are looking at when they're reviewing these cases.
Some protesters around the country are throwing out words like tyranny and totalitarian. I don't know what your definition of these words are, but is that what's happening when states exercise these precautionary measures?
You know, I think Greg and I have both been in, and I think most people are deferential to what government's doing because the danger here is so great. The health danger is so great. But I do think that you also have to recognize how serious of an intrusion this is on people's lives. It's not just the limitation on being able to earn money, the limitations on being able to go to church or to be able to engage in a protest are really serious. And so I think people are correct in the instinct of saying, we better make sure that we're doing the right thing here. Because the intrusions are so great. Now, I do think that here, because this disease is so great and the dangers of this disease are so great, we got 70,000 people who've died already, that the government is justified here in doing what it's doing. But I don't think we should forget the fact that these intrusions are so great as well when we're thinking about this in the broader sense of the term, in broader sense of the
I have about 40 seconds left, and we've talked about where the intersection of my rights come into combat with your rights or the rights of the majority, but 72% of the people in this country say they agree with what's been going on with these closures, etc. But where does the tyranny of the majority infringe on the rights of the people who are protesting who do not agree with this, Greg?
Well, I think that the question here is whether that 70% really understand what government is doing. Maybe many of them have not felt the onerous burden of these orders. And I do think that that we have to be very careful about sacrificing our liberty for our safety.
Greg Wallace is a professor of law at Campbell University of Constitutional Law, as is William Marshall, who is at the UNC's School of Law. I guess these arguments will keep going on for the duration of the Republic. But thank you for joining us this hour, and stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.